Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, now that I'm back at home, I want to get back on my schedule. I'll try to do one yard site a week. And Gabbai and my show announced on Shabbos, he said a couple of names, and one of them is Rev Herzog. I said, whoa, Rev Herzog, that's an easy one to do, or at least an interesting one catches my attention. And so I'll share that with you. For those of you who don't know I'm talking about, especially if you're yeshivish, Rabbi Yitzhak Isaac Alevi Herzog was the chief rabbi of Israel after Rav Kook. Now, today, the chief rabbi of Israel is no big deal. In fact, I'll bet you a lot of people are listening to this a lot. Don't even know who the chief rabbi of Israel is. It doesn't even matter to them. Because it's fallen into a low estate. It's like everything else. It's politics. You know, the two current chief rabbis of Israel are the sons of the previous ones. So, you know, that was what you call a merit appointment in Jewish life. But, on the other hand, the chief rabbi was set up around 1920. First, Rav Kook, who is obviously extremely famous, and turned into a cult figure. Interesting to me, Rav Herzog did not happen to him. So let me talk a little bit what I'm speaking about, because probably many of you don't have an idea who I'm speaking of. Rabbi Herzog, Rabbi Yitzhak Isaac Alevi Herzog, was a very unusual person. He died in 59, so he was born in 1888. So, you know, lived in the First World War, Second World War period. He was the chief rabbi of Israel, see, when Israel became a state, first decade and all that. But that doesn't do justice to it, because he was out of the box, and that's what makes him interesting, at least to me, and that is, Herzog was born somewhere in Poland, I think in Lomża, you know, to Yeshivisha type family. His father was a rabbi, but when he was around 10 years old or so, they became part of the great wave of Lithuanian and Russian Jews that moved to the West, and they came to England. I think his father was a rabbi in Leeds. And he was a young guy, he was 10 years old, coming from a very Lomdisha type environment. Lomdisha had a big yeshiva. Let me get straight. Yeah, I'm talking to Americans. There's Lomdis and there's Lomdisha. Lomdis is learning. Lomdisha is the name of a city. Okay? There used to be a famous yeshiva in the town called Lomdisha. So there was Lomdis and Lomdisha, but there's not Lomdisha and Lomdis. Anyhow, so he came from such a background. Now, he was a genius. So from early on, he's obviously one of these Eloys. Like, he's a real thing, like really read about. Photographic memory, very smart, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, his father moved to England. Ain't no yeshivas in England. Not at that time. So what? He learned at home. And he went to public school. And that's right. When I say public school, probably went to boys Latin, you know, a good school. And so here's somebody who becomes a famous rabbi, does not ever go to yeshiva, is growing up in England. But on the other hand, it's the old England. It's like the old Baltimore of 100 years ago. It's all Eastern European Jews, Yiddish all over the place, and plenty of religious Jews at that time, and plenty of Talmidei Chachamim. You still had that element, I'll say again, of 100, 120 years ago, where a lot of people came over were, you know, the Balabatim knew how to learn, as they say, from the old days. And found themselves in England, one place or another, for one reason or another. And so if you're an unusual kid growing up, you're not like the other English kids, and you know how to learn, you know, Yiddish, you know how to read a sefer, and you know more than that, if your father's a rabbi, he learns with you every day, I'm sure that's what happened. So, you're different than the other kids around you, but you can talk to the adults in learning, and that's what he obviously did. He grew up, therefore, I guess, in the time of King Edward. So, you know, between 1898 and 1908, figure like that. And he went to college. And I remember he got an M.A. eventually in France. Because what happened was his father eventually got an offer to be the rabbi of the Frum Shul in Paris. That's a whole subject by itself. What we're basically talking about over here is the late 1800s. And what happened was the following, very briefly. Let me say this. Tonight, here in Baltimore, Monday night, I'm starting a lecture series, as I do every year, on the 3 weeks, on some episode in Jewish history that's sad. Because it's 3 weeks. So I've done many over the years, and this year I'm doing a series called The Russian Pogroms of 1881, Harbinger of Extermination or Blessing in Disguise. And it's 6 lectures. And it's about the, obviously as the title says, the pogroms that broke out in Russia, which among other things triggered over the course of the next 20 years, a mass immigration. So several million Jews leave what you and I call Eastern Europe. And they went to the West, many to America, of course, and many to England and places like that. And also many to France and Germany and other countries in Western Europe. So a ton of Jews moved to Paris, to France, starting in the 1880s. And the official French Jewry, the Rabbanut they have there, never went exactly conservative or reform. But Lamaisa said they were like conservative. That's what they were, Lamaisa. So don't be surprised. I mean, you know, many shuls have organ, and I'll say it again, they never went reform, but they introduced a lot of these Meshuggah French changes in order to kiss up to the Goyim. That's who the French Jews were. They were overly obsequious. The French Jews are the subject of a famous essay by the famous Zionist writer, Achad Ha'am, who was atheist. A chart cover chassid who became an atheist. And Hanukkah called Avdus Betocheres, slavery within freedom. In other words, you French Jews think you're free and you are technically liberated. That is to say, you have equal citizenship with the others, but you're always bending your backwards to show how French you are. So the Russian Jews who moved there didn't like to go to those kind of shuls. And so they ended up making their own like mini Kehilla. The French rich Jews were so freaked out that the Russian Jews will have bunch of small shtiebels that'll be unappetizing looking and smelling and all the rest. And they actually kicked in money for the Frum community, the Russian Jews, to build a large synagogue. I forget what street it's on. Hisachdus HaKehillas. And this Rabbi Herzog was the rabbi there. So this is a young guy growing up in Leeds and then in Paris. And he went to college in Paris. That's where he did his MA on the Tchelis. Dying of purple in ancient Israel, which already goes to show you he wants to use his secular knowledge to understand Torah topics. Because the big question is there tchelis nowadays? And I'm no expert on that. I've never been interested in that subject, but I know enough to know that the famous Rajina Rebbe, the Hasidic Rebbe, earlier in the 1800s, has said he found a tchelis somewhere in Italy, and it was all messed up. It turned out he was wrong. And Rav Herzog, you know, who was interested in marine biology, among many other subjects. Now, this is a guy, I'll give the story away. He ends up knowing Holshas and everything. I mean, Babel, Yishalmi, the whole nine yards, everything. And one of the great Gedolim. But at the same time, he had college education. And he was interested in science and every other subject. And he does his MA thesis on a tchelis, which he identified with a certain type of snail, which today is the one they say, those who hold from tchelis, say is the real one. So, I just think you're a very unusual guy. Didn't go to yeshiva, knows everything. Obviously, you can't know everything without chazring over Shas, Bab, Yishalmi, Tezefta, Mechel, Tezifra, Rishonim, Achronim, over and over again. And somehow or other is at the same time also, you know, taking multiple degrees in college, because I remember he did his MA in Paris in the Sorbonne. That's the tchelis thing. But he also did a law PhD, believe it or not, in the University of London around like 1914 or whatever. So this is one smart dude. And then it's already the First World War. And he got married in London to the daughter of a big Talmud Chacham. Talk about it a little bit later. And then he was a rabbi in Northern Ireland, the part that belongs to England, Belfast. So, like, in the first years of the First World War, he was a rabbi in Belfast. And then he was a rabbi in Dublin. Now, you got to understand, Belfast and Dublin in the years I'm talking about, which is the First World War and the aftermath, that's the years of, what's the guy's name? Not Tom Collins. That's a drink. Michael Collins. That's it. You probably don't have any idea what I'm talking about. These are the terrorists who made the Irish Republic. Eamon de Valera and Michael Collins. This is the era of Mamish the terrorism, which they forced the English out of Ireland. There are books and movies and things like this all about it. The IRA, right? You've heard of the IRA. Sinn Féin. So this is a heck of a time to be a rabbi in Ireland. But guess what? A bunch of Jews, about 5,000, moved to Dublin. And that's right, in the middle of Dublin. And Dublin became the capital of what they called the Irish Free State. Like a certain chalik of the British Empire. It's too complicated to go into now. But there were shootings and crazy things going on all the time. And this guy becomes the Rav of the Jewish community in Dublin, which Lamaisa means they become the chief rabbi of Ireland. Ireland became a new country around 1920, after all the fighting with the British. And therefore he becomes, let's put it this way, poster boy for Irish nationalism, because there were 5,000 Litvish Jews in Dublin. That made a Jewish neighborhood. 5,000 is a lot. It's not huge, but it's a lot. Ireland was weird. There are no Jews anywhere else, hardly. But in one packed area were shuls and this and that and the other, and they chose him as the rabbi, and I don't blame him, because first of all, he's a gone, a young guy. Second of all, he had a PhD. And third of all, he had a mastery of languages. And so he learned Gaelic, you know, which is the brand new language of Ireland, better than the Irish did. And he was able to win the favor of the Irish, which was very good for the Jewish community. Let me put it this way. When Ireland became a state, it was totally Catholic. But they were bending over backwards to show that they're not totally Catholic, and they're totally tolerant in order to get sympathy for the struggle against England. Otherwise, England would say, why should Ireland become a state? They're going to bring in the Inquisition, you know, be totally Catholic. So the Irish said, no. We're Catholic, but we're very tolerant, and everybody has equal rights. And look, here's the chief rabbi. He's Jewish. Orthodox Jew, a Talmud scholar, and he's treated with the biggest coven. And I remember he went to America on behalf of the Irish Republic, you know, which won him a lot of favor, you know, on a speaking tour. So it won him a lot of favor among the Goyim as well as among the Jews. So he's a great man in this particular regard. And there's a very famous joke. I remember years ago that, how's it go? He came to New York and he was introduced by Jimmy Walker, the famous playboy who was the mayor of New York of yesteryear, who said, ladies and gentlemen, I have a story to tell you. Once upon a time, there was a Jew and an Irishman, which is how a lot of stories used to begin. There's a Jew and an Irishman, and here he is. they introduced Rabbi Herzog. Now, at the same time, the guy knew, like, Kol HaTorah Kulo. So he's a young, relatively young man, 1888, and I'm talking about in his 30s, and he has a huge, growing reputation. Didn't go to yeshiva. He got picked up smich, I don't know where, you know, somewhere along the way, but that doesn't mean anything. His father's a big rabbi also. And he would have been perfect, in my opinion, for chief rabbi of England. Maybe he's a little too frum, but the PhD from English University he had, he could speak English very well. He could speak probably 10, 12 languages. I'm serious. And this is a very unusual guy. Now, here comes the interesting, I mean, all this, here comes an interesting part. How did I encounter Rabbi Herzog decades ago when I was much younger? When he was the chief rabbi of Ireland, so obviously he gives speeches, gives shiurim to individual students and things like that. But where is the chance for you to use what you got? You know, yeah, not too much room in no yeshivas in Ireland. So he undertook, because he had the law degree and a philosophy degree or something like that, put out in English a five-volume work, which we call The Main Institutions of Jewish Law, which are amazing, published in the 1930s, in which he undertakes to explain all the principles, what you and I would call Choshen Mishpat, from the point of view of a law professor. And I remember reading this when I was much younger, and the Hebrew College Library, I was like, whoa, because he'll explain all the principles of Jewish law. Let me give you an example. Kenyan, Yush, Shibud, things like that. And, asmachta, all kind of ideas out there in Lumdus, in a legalistic way, meaning like a law professor does it. No, I'm not finished. But not like these 99.9% of all the other scholars of my youth. They couldn't learn to save their lives. And so if they quote a line in the Talmud, it shows you that they think they know how to learn. He's bringing down the, and it's all in English, mind you. The Ketzos, the Nesivos, the Or Sameach, the Machna Ephraim, all within a brilliant exposition. I tell you, it's a masterwork. And you should read it today. If you're listening to this podcast and you're inspired by what I said, you'll go out there and find, now they sell it in bookstores. Rabbi Herzog's Main Institutions of Jewish Law. Unfortunately, he only finished two volumes because it would have finished five if he would have stayed in Ireland. However, came the 1930s, and while he's writing these things, we must have given a university lecture or something like that because they're written in a very clear and organized way. You could learn let me put it this way, you could learn a lot from reading his English book. but what happened was Rav Kook died, and they were looking for a successor. This is 1935 or so, and he got elected, which is amazing because, it's not that amazing. Let's put it this way. He was a Mizrahi. He was a Zionist. Anybody living in Western Europe, that's not true what I'm saying, but a lot of people living in Western Europe would support Zionism, even though they would do it from a firm perspective, like the Mizrahi style and all the rest of it. He was not a Goethe type at all, which was held against him by the Goethe types. But he was, as I say, sympathetic with Zionism and all the rest of it. And the result is that the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael in Palestine, which is, the Ben-Gurion era, in the 1930s, they wanted the successor of Kook because the Jewish community had set up under the British mandate in Palestine, the British were ruling, their own court system of religious courts. This is something the British wanted to set up. It's left over from the Turks. The British took over Palestine, as you know, I'm sure, after the First World War from the Turks. The Turks had ruled it for 400 years. The Turks ran everything all based on religion. Your identity is your religion. This is a Jew. This is a Christian. This is a Muslim. They didn't say this guy's a French Jew or something like that. He's a Jew. Any more than they say this guy's an Arab Muslim or a Syrian Muslim or something. He's a Muslim. So it's defined in religion, which means that they kept the old-fashioned Jewish way of autonomous course of communities. The Beisans had koach. And even when the British took over and they wouldn't give the Beisan a power like to beat somebody up, I don't know, for, be Michal Shabbos, but they left a considerable amount of power in the hands of the Beisans, specifically marriage and divorce, things like that. And without going into all the details, it'd take too long, in 1920 or so, the British did pass a law giving legal power to a Rabbanut system headed by a chief rabbi and an appeals court and a Supreme Court. And this was running in Israel down to the current day, which is why, from that time on until the current day, you can't get officially married in Israel if you don't do a Kedasa Kedin. It's got to be done by a rabbi. There's no such thing as a justice of the peace in Israel. Not yet. There's no such thing as a civil marriage like you have in America in Israel. Not yet. It's still run by the rabbis, by the halacha. So Rav Kook is the one who set this up. The Aguda, by the way, said they don't hold from it, but now they kind of use it. When Rav Kook died in 35, the question is, who's going to be the next chief rabbi of Israel? It's got to be a Zionist. It's got to be a big Talmid Chacham. There were two candidates, mainly, at the 1930s. One was Rav Kook's assistant, his number two man, Rabbi Charlap, who is a great Talmid Chacham and a big tzaddik, and super Zionist, beyond, super Mizrahi, super duper duper. But he had no secular education. They had this younger guy, who was about 40 years old, Rav Herzog, who had a PhD. He was also a big Talmid Chacham. Well, he won. Many were afraid if he's got a college degree, maybe he's not from. That's how people thought in those days. And listen to this. It's all who you know. Rav Herzog was the son-in-law of a big rabbi in England. That rabbi in England was a Talmud Muvak of Chaim Eiser, Brzezinski in Vilna. His name was Hillman, Shmuel Hillman. And So his father-in-law wrote to Reb Chaim Moser, you know, put in a word for my son. Let's put it this way. If Reb Chaim Moser gives an answer on this guy's orthodoxy, what are you going to say? If that's what happened. Even the Chazanish, believe it or not, who moved recently in Palestine, support him. I'm not sure exactly why, but anyway, but that's what happened. So he got elected the second chief rabbi of Israel. Now, this to me is something you could talk about for 2 hours, because Rav Herzog was brilliant and a genius, but like I said before, he didn't develop the fan base the Rav Kook does. You know, you go to Israel today, even around the world, people are into Kooknicks, right? They're nuts over Rav Kook, this, that, and the other. And you don't find it ever for Rav Herzog. He had a scholar's personality. He didn't have this, I don't know what's the right word, this charismatic magnetism, apparently, that Rav Kook had. It's very interesting. But on the other hand, let's put it this way. He was a Bar Hochi. He knew how to learn better than anybody. So it's a bunch of funny stories. When he arrived in Palestine, you can bet your bottom dollar, all these real frumies in Yerushalayim, Bnei Brak, all the rest, they said, a guy with college, what does he know? You know, they just took him because it's a Zionistic business and the Zionists, and it's all, politics and all the rest of it. Until you start talking to him and learning. You know, that was the end of that. So, and there are many stories. I'm not going to take the time to go into all the Maisalach, but it's very interesting. And he set himself up in Yerushalayim. The fact that he could speak English, which the other rabbis couldn't do because he had an education in England, it was a big help. The fact that he had a university degree, he's Rabbi Dr. Herzog, was a big help. And at the same time, you know, all the big Rabbanim in Yerushalayim, I'm talking about Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, you know, the Tuchachinsky, all the big rabbis in Israel, and the up-and-coming ones, like Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was a young guy, they all sound like, wow, this Rabbi Herzog is amazing. Anybody out there who's into learning, I'll say this. When I was, there's his father-in-law, Rabbi Hillman, was a rabbi and a dayan in London in the early part of the 20th century. I have a nice cartoon I'm looking to hang up in my house about the London Basin. It's kind of interesting. But anyway, and then he retired. You go get a pension, and he moved to Yerushalayim, and he wrote this 7-volume business, which I picked up many years ago when I was very young, called Ora Yashar. And it's and the beauty of the set is he's got something on every daf and shas. Right? So over the years, if I ever needed something, look something up, one of the places you look at a classic cheetah place is the Ora Yashar. Because whatever daf you're on, he'll have something to say. Maybe something you can use, maybe something you can't use. Or he'll give you sources, Amar Makomas. Say he was one of those shas people. In the Or HaYashar, again, this is the follow-up of Herzog. In the Or HaYashar, I remember when you get to the sections of Kachem, he has this huge stuff there, you know, like pages and pages of Chidushim and heavy-duty lamdas on Kachem material, Chulin, Zvachim, and Achas from his son-in-law, from Herzog. So anybody wants to get an acquaintance with his style of lamdas, which is pretty heavy, you look in the Or HaYashar and the Kachem parts. So I'm just telling you that. Anyway, Rav Herzog was the rabbi when the World War II started. And he tried his best to save the yeshivas. He was friends with the president of Ireland because he made his business to be friends with the president of Ireland, who was a very famous Irishman called Eamon de Valera. He's a very controversial figure, but he was the president of Ireland for 20, 30 years. And because he was friends with Rav Herzog, he wasn't anti-Semitic and all that. At least he didn't let on. And he tried to say, well, Ireland taking the yeshiva boys running away, the Beis Yaakov girls. But, you know, it didn't work. Because at the end of the day, the Jews are alone. Am Bodod Yeshev. All your friends left you in the lurch during the 30s and 40s. All the fair weather friends, Roosevelt, Churchill, all the others. By the time the Jews got shechted, nobody really did anything. So, but he gave it his best shot. And he traveled to the United States of America in 1940 or in 1941 to see Franklin Roosevelt, to see if he could get him to let in all the yeshiva boys into America. It did not work, believe it or not. Now, how did he get in to see Roosevelt? As I said, his father-in-law, Rabbi Herzog's father-in-law, was Ralph Hillman. He was a famous Talmid Chacham. Ralph Hillman had a cousin who had gone to Slobodka, but then became totally not from and became a Bundist. And then moved to America and became head of the national unions, Sidney Hillman. is a famous name if you know your American history, especially the New Deal. Sidney Hillman was like a very high Union official at the time of Roosevelt, like at the top of the top. And so Sidney Hillman got him to see Roosevelt. But Roosevelt gave him the time of day, notice he shot the bull with him, and he would not give any kind of commitment to help anybody from or help anybody Jewish. It was a very bitter disappointment for Herzog. It doesn't surprise us who know about Roosevelt, but it surprised him. He must have thought with his charm he'd be able to convince Roosevelt, but it didn't work. And then Ralph Herzog said, "I'm returning to Israel." Well, they said, "Don't go back to Israel. This is 1941. This is before America entered the war. The Germans are winning. The British were losing. They're getting closer to Palestine. They might break in and kill everybody." And he didn't care. He took a boat across the Atlantic. As a famous story, he was supposed to take the Robin Moore, famous ship. But last minute, for some reason, he changed ships. And the Robin Moore is a famous story where the Germans sank it off the coast of Africa. But he got to South Africa, and then he flew to Israel, Palestine, right when Rommel was there. No, when the Germans were right at the door. And it's a very famous thing. People say, "How can you go back?" And he said that in the Torah tradition, there are two korbans. This is Bayis Rishon, this is Bayis Sheni. It's nice I'm saying this. Now I'm saying this podcast right after Shavuot and Matamos. It's the middle of 3 weeks. It says, this is what Rav Herzog said, when he risked his life, he put his life where money where his mouth is. He said, "I'm returning to Eretz Yisrael because I know there's not going to be a third korban." Our sages talk about two korbans and not a third. There's even a medrash he quoted. I think it was Kashani Shacholti Shacholti. When Yaakov says to, who is it? Yehuda, take Binyamin. Don't take Binyamin. Shacholti Shacholti. I'm mourning twice. So the medrash says there's a Bayis Rishon, Bayis Sheni, but there's no third korban. So he believed that enough to say, "I'm coming back to Israel, even though the German army is next door. It will not happen." And of course, in the end, the Germans were defeated. But at that time, people didn't know it. So he was a courageous guy. It's very interesting in this regard. And he spent the war trying to do these hasal things, but nothing worked. As we know, nothing substantial worked. And he got involved with the politics. That's when the Mizrach and the Aguda started fighting like cats and dogs. It's very sad. The war was going on, and they're all fighting with each other. I'm sorry to say. And when the war was over, he went to Europe to try to save, let me rephrase this, to try to pick up kids who were in monasteries and Christian homes and things like that. He even met with the Pope and others. The big push at the end of the war was, obviously, to get Israel. Number two, to save the Sheretz HaPleita. Number three, to recover kids who had, so to speak, been taken from their parents and they weren't giving them back. And he was very active in that sort of thing. This was the real Hatzalah work. And then, of course, Israel became a state, as I think everybody knows. And he became the first chief rabbi of Israel. As the chief rabbi of Israel, he actually wrote up a constitution. The guy had a legal degree besides everything else. And so he could write a constitution up. And it's been published recently called Hatchukah. That's the Hebrew word for from Chok, Hatchukah L'Medinat Israel. And I remember, I bought it a number of years ago. I read it once, but it was like all of his stuff is very lumpish. And he says, "So we'll have a theocracy. Saudi Arabia has a theocracy. Big deal." Go say that today. Especially a guy from college background. So, let me put it this way. Israel today, you may not know this, does not have a constitution. And it's probably a good thing. But, they never could have enough agreement on fundamentals in Israel to make a constitution up between the from, the not from, this group, left, the right, up and down. So his idea didn't go anywhere. The modern state of Israel, for the first 10 years, he was the chief rabbi, but then he was getting old. And he got, sick over the years. So you can see pictures of him online, like attending, the Panovich dedication of the campus and all that. But once the state of Israel came into being, he also started the Kanoim. And a lot of people used to knock him and diss him and this and that and the other because he's a Zionist, because he went to Medina. I don't remember all the stories, but a lot of sordid stories that they wouldn't let him speak at a at a funeral or something like that, and then the one let him come at a some dedication. I don't remember exactly. The problem is, he couldn't beat him in learning, and he wasn't tzaddik, and he's the type of guy who used to give a lot of money away. He was nice, you know what I'm saying? He gave money away to the poor. He really was that type. I remember there was a refugee doctor who knows a German who made it to Israel, an MD, but couldn't make a go of it, and he had no patience and all this. And Rav Herzog would call him in and say, oh, I feel sick. And he'd give him a whole checkup and say, you're fine. And then he'd call him in a month later, you know, and you're fine. Now, the reason is he wanted to pay him, get it? It was a way of you know, giving him a payment for a visit. But the guy told the Rebbe, and he says, your husband is suffering from severe hypochondria. Because he was too stupid, the Yankee, you know, he was too stupid to realize that the guy was actually giving him charity. So he's a very interesting person in this regard, but at the same time, a kind of a failure, because he didn't finish the 5 volumes, which would have made his name, you know, huge. He didn't publish anything significant. They have some tshuvas of his, Heichal Yitzchak. I never found it. I don't know why. That tells you something. They were published like in the 50s, and he's got an important psukim. Let me tell you something. He was there in the 40s and 50s, so he was one of the big people that had to deal with the Aguna question. You tell me about the Aguna situation after World War II, baby. Right? You understand what I'm talking about? You know, the husband and wife were in the concentration camps, and then the husband is not coming back. And is he dead? Is he not dead? It's a terrible aftermath of World War II. He dealt with a lot of big shilas when the State of Israel came into being. But already by then, you know, let's put it this way. The Haredi world doesn't care what he says. They went into what Chazon Ish says. I mean, that's the politics of it. And I think it's therefore kind of a disappointing life, because for a person had all of his gifts. This is interesting to me. A person had all his gifts and huge knowledge. And really, I don't know anybody like him in the 20th century. You understand? Meaning, I don't know anybody who was as big a gone in all areas, who occupied a position, the chief rabbinate of the most important place, Eretz Yisrael, a person with a very solid secular education, very eloquent, and all that sort of thing. He carried himself with a lot of dignity. You see pictures of him with the top hat, always very well dressed, and with a silver cane, you know, so he should impress the goyim. He didn't get any following. You know, it's a funny business. He didn't get a big following. He's not Rav Kook. Rav Kook's books are constantly reprinted. Herzog's I never see reprinted, or hardly anyway. Rav Kook has a million biographies. I think of Herzog has maybe one. I have it. The Yachid Bedero. It's kind of funny. I don't think he had this passionate, what's the right word? You know, charismatic personality, which for better or worse is what turns people on. He was a tremendous scholar, a person of great. He had all the milas. You know, he was kind. He was good. He helped people. He could give a shiur better than anybody, but he didn't have a yeshiva. In the mid 20th century, first half of the 20th century, he was alive. The main people that emerged as important figures in the firm world are the Rosh Yeshivas, not the rabbis. It's quite interesting in that regard. He was a person who spent all his life in the rabbinate, because I guess that's the background he came from. If a guy like that would have started a yeshiva, especially with his English and Hebrew background, it would have been probably amazing. But instead, he went around in Israel and from the yeshiva, yeshiva gave a shiurim. But, you know, he didn't occupy the type of occupational role that turns out to be the one that in the non-Hasidic world gets the most traction and charisma in the course of the 20th century. That's why I bet you a lot of people listening to me now are saying, who's this Rabbi Herzog that he's talking about? I don't know if I've done justice to him. As you see, I'm very interested. But he's a fascinating personality. And maybe as a result of what I said, you will be moved to you know, read some of his books, especially the English ones you could read if you got the head for it. And especially the one, not the Tchelis one, the one on the main institutions of Jewish law, I found very interesting, very remarkable. Again, you know, because he's got older Rishonim Achronim there that you wouldn't ordinarily see in an English book, at least when I was growing up. And he has a total command of all the subject matter, as you can see. He was a good speaker. If you look online, you can find here and there some speeches he gave. Like, I remember one about Sukkah, someone about Dar Sameach. You know, he's a good orator, like a rabbi part. But at the end of the day, the rabbis don't get the big traction, do they? And it's also true that being the chief rabbi in Israel means you're also connected with all the bureaucracy and all the politics and all the schmutz. So the chief rabbinate of Israel is a very interesting institution. Rav Kook was on a huge height. Rav Herzog was a little less than him, but also on a huge height. After Rav Herzog, you don't think the chief rabbis of Israel are not people that are so hugely inspiring or anything like that. It's a disappointing office. There are reasons for it, of course, but that's the way it turned out. So the two big chief rabbis in the history of Israel, everybody has to be motivated, were huge gaonim and all the rest of it, is Rav Kook and Rav Herzog. Rav Kook did not go to college and was not that sort of thing, and Rav Herzog was that. Anyway, that's enough for now. I've gone over my usual time limit anyway. So good night.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.